Welcome to this session. My name is Andres Monroy Hernandez, and I'm a researcher at Microsoft Research currently, but I'm going to present to you some of the work that I did when I was at the MIT Media Lab. So the focus of this presentation is on how to design creative online communities, in particular for kids, for children. And I'm going to talk to you about this topic in the context of an online community that I built, hoping that some of the lessons that we learn and some of the stories might inspire you to think about, you know, how you might create a community for kids, or how you might study a community for kids. So first, I just wanted to start with this image that I found a few days ago. This is an image of what they call Paleo Future. It was a French artist who drew this, and he was basically imagining how the year 2000 would look like, and this was back in early 1900s. And this is an image of how, you know, a barber shop would look like in the future, and, you know, you can see that everything's automated with these machines, and, you know, you will just sit down and something will a machine will shave you. So to me, this was interesting because, you know, as a technologist, when we think about problems like education, you know, learning, healthcare, all these things, we always think about technological solutions for this, and we often think in terms of what is currently the status quo. And actually, in the same set of vignettes, I found this one that I thought was very telling. This is a technical solution that in the year 2000 we will have for education. And you can see that the idea here is just that, you know, you will have this machine that you will drop books into it, and then, you know, kids will magically learn everything that is in those books, kind of like in the Matrix. So I thought it was interesting because in some ways I feel like this is what we are doing right now, where, you know, a lot of the technologies that are designed for kids and for education are, in fact, you know, trying to replicate what books are doing. If you think of, you know, the Khan Academy even. If you think of the Khan Academy, for example, it's all about, you know, basically transferring information from, you know, a computer to a kid. And I think that was I think that's interesting because it's something that a lot of research has shown that is just a small part of learning. It's a very small part of learning, just this idea of transmission of information. And in fact, we are really good at it. I mean, we already have books, we have TVs, but there is a lot more that technology can do than just delivering information. And this gets to my first point, which is, you know, when you are designing online communities for kids, especially when you think about kids, a lot of the discussions are around education and learning. You have to have a set some values that you are kind of trying to implement. And, you know, you could be thinking about how do we improve education or how do we, you know, make things more creative. And so I found a lot of inspiration on this book. It's a book from 1980. It's a book that established this kind of new mind frame for how education should be and how learning should be. And this Seymour Papert, who wrote this book, coined the term constructionism. And the idea behind constructionism is very simple, and it's not new, actually. The idea is that, you know, the richest learning experiences happen when people are invested in creating personally meaningful artifacts. So rather than consuming information, you're producing stuff. It could be a tower made of Legos, or it could be a computer program, it could be a cake. The idea here is that, you know, the richest learning experiences are those that involve people making and creating things. So this was built on some of the theories from Jean Piaget and other educators. But so you can see that this kind of philosophy can be implemented in different ways. So one of the first ways in which this was implemented was in the construction of the Lego Mindstorms kit. I don't know, how many of you are familiar with Lego Mindstorms? So a lot of you are. So Lego Mindstorms is a robotics kit for kids using Legos. And this implements this idea of constructionism, you know, how do we create tools, technology, that rather than delivering information, allow people to build things? So that's one example. And actually, before that one, right after the book came out, the programming language called Logo was implemented based on those ideas. You know, the idea that, you know, we have personal computers back in the 70s or 80s, and then how do we enable kids to be creators using these computers? So Logo was a programming language that allowed kids to program those computers. And of course, you know, it was early in the PC era, so the kind of things people would make were very simple. In this case, people would make like turtle graphics, as they call them, and basically you will program this turtle to move around the screen and draw things for you, like a square, a triangle, or a house. So those two projects were, you know, in inspired by this constructionist idea, and I think it's very important that when we are building technologies, we have, one, a goal in mind, and also a process by which we want to achieve that goal, and that we rethink some of the, you know, established ways in which education or technologies for kids are often thought about. You know, typically we think about, like, if you look at the iPad, for example, a lot of the iPad apps for kids are, you know, interactive books, or basically information delivery mechanisms. Another theory that I found really interesting was this book from 1970. And I found it interesting for two reasons. The first one is because he talks about this idea that, you know, he sees back in the 70s, even, you know, this problem with education, how it's, you know, not evenly distributed among society, how it's, you know, not empowering people. So he proposes this idea of learning webs. And this was before the web or even the internet was mainstream. And what he proposed was the idea that, you know, we might have technologies that connect people, and people with similar interests, and that they together create a peer learning network. And he didn't use the word network, he used the word web. But I thought it was very inspiring because it was, you know, that's what we see in a lot of these online communities today. Communities like, you know, Stack Overflow or, you know, even Reddit and other communities where people are coming together and in many cases learning from each other and building on each other's work. So I'm going to show to you an example of one of these technologies that I was involved in building, and this is the Scratch online community. And this is based on the three ideas that I want to propose to you. One is that, you know, a community should be about building an audience for people. So again, if we believe that this idea of, you know, empowering people to create things is fun to create, but you want to have an audience for your creations, and those objects that you're creating, those artifacts, you should be able to share them and you know, publish them and share them with the world. And maybe find peers that, you know, you might collaborate with. So here is a quick video demo of the system that I built. This is the Scratch online community. So it's a website similar to YouTube, Flickr, all these other sites. But here, kids are building and sharing their own interactive media. They share animations, they share games, they share, you know, kind of interactive music videos, all sorts of things that they program themselves, and they show them to the world. So you can go to the website. It's called scratch.mit.edu, and you'll find tons of projects that kids from all over the world have made. You can see here in the popular tags, you know, the kind of projects that people have made. Animation and art is one of the main ones. So there are tons of projects there that you can check out. If you go to somebody's profile, again, you know, this idea of having a space where you can share your objects, you can see, you know, this user has a bunch of projects. You can click on some of those projects, and you can see what these projects are about. So in this case, it's a game. It's a spaceship that you can control with a keyboard. And one of the things that I like about this project is that this kid drew the images, and then he scanned them, and then, you know, put them on his game, and then each one of these images became a character in the game. So you can play with that with the keyboard. And one of the cool things about the website, you know, just like many other social media websites, it allows you to connect with your audience. So here you can see tons of comments that kids from all over have posted on that particular project. And, you know, a lot of them are about what the score was, you know, asking questions about how this kid made the video, the project. So that's one way in which people connect. In addition to that, you know, with any particular project, let me just click here. You can download the project. So, you know, this idea of open access to content where you can access the project and download it in the Scratch programming environment. So this is the editor, basically. You can consume content on the website and you can make things on this software. You can see that each one of the characters has blocks associated to it. So these blocks determine the way in which each character behaves. It's basically programming code in the shape of blocks, kind of like puzzle pieces. So you can play around with the puzzle pieces, you know, take them apart, tweak them, and by doing these tweaks, you can learn how other people's projects were made. You can, you know, change parameters, you can, you know, play around with the different costumes, you can, you know, make edits to the images themselves, you can add your own images. So this is a way in which many kids get to start with Scratch by remixing other people's projects, which is actually how I also, you know, learned how to program when I was in middle school. And I think this is one way in which a lot of people learn how to program. One of the cool things about Scratch is that it's multilingual. So you can see that now I changed the language to Spanish, and all the blocks are in Spanish, even though they were originally programmed in English. You can also change to something like Hebrew, for example, and all your blocks will change from right to left now. So you can really, you know, be able to, you are able to create something in your own language that, and then share it with anyone in any other language, basically because we have a constrained vocabulary that allows us to easily translate the blocks from one language to another. So that's one thing that people can do. In addition to that, there is this idea of remixing again. So this project, for example, has 10 remixes. When I click on the remixes link, I can see a small visualization of all the remixes that that project has generated. So then I can click on one of those remixes, and actually this was created back during the 2008 election. So one of the kids downloaded that project of the spaceship and made a change to it. And you'll see he changed some of the images and some of the play dynamics. So you can see that John McCain is now on the spaceship. And as you play with it, you'll see that Hillary Clinton is also featured on the game. So the idea behind Scratch is basically you can make anything that you see in the website, you can make it personal. So in this case, this kid cared about the election, and actually he says here, you know, like the instructions for the game, and then he says, sorry if this offends you. I can read here, but he basically says, sorry if it offends you. I'm a Democrat, and I like this game because I would like to make fun of Republicans. So you can see that kids really make these games personal. They make this something that they care about. Now, you know, kind of trying to understand what has happened on the community. In the past 4 years since we released the website, we have had more than 1 million accounts that were registered on the website. About a quarter of them have made a project. So it's pretty large compared to other communities where, you know, there's a very distinctive number of people who consume versus people who produce. But you can see here about a quarter of them are people who have produced projects. There are about 2 million projects on the website. There is a new project about every minute. So if you go to the website now and you refresh the page, you might see different projects. There are 25% of those projects are remixes of other people's projects. So this, all, again, gives you an idea of the importance of remixing in this community. And then for those who remix, about 71% of them have created a remix as their very first project. So again, the idea that remixing allows you to get started, basically. And this is something that I think often schools don't really consider, where, you know, oftentimes in more traditional educational environments, it's all about, you know, you have to make your things by yourself without being, you know, influenced or inspired by other people. So I think here the dynamics change a little bit. In terms of monthly activity, you can see the site goes, you know, has continuously increased in terms of number of projects, number of users. In a particular month, we had, on that spike, we had about 65,000 projects that month, about 28,000 new users that month, and about 16,000 of those were remixes. So you can see that the rate of remixes to projects is pretty stable. In terms of who is using the website, so here you can see 18 years of age is the peak, but you see a long tail of users. And this is actually something really interesting because, you know, the community and the website and the tool itself was designed for kids between, you know, 11 to 16, 17. But when you create something that is easy to use, there are other people who want to use it. So even with, you know, you can see this with Lego products as well. There's a lot of adults who are really into Lego, and we see the same in Scratch. So you can see some 21-year-olds, 30-year-olds, and even like 60 and older. So one of the things that we saw is that there were some, you know, engineers, you know, adult engineers, programmers, who were really inspired by Scratch, and they wanted to push the limits of Scratch and then see how far they could get. There was this guy, actually, who lives in Maine. He's a retired engineer from GE, and he showed Scratch to his grandkids, and then he became really hooked in Scratch. So he started making all these really cool projects, and then people started asking him how he made those projects. He became like a really active member of the community, helping other kids to program. And then, you know, we realized that he was becoming really active in the community, so we made him to be a moderator of the community. And now he's like an established member of the community. You know, he's kind of like a mentor for a lot of the kids. So we see a lot of these stories happening over and over again. In terms of visitors per month, we have about 1 million visitors per month in terms of Google Analytics. And people are coming from all over the world. So again, Scratch was originally designed for for, you know, being a multilingual and international community, and it is represented here for, you know, in terms of the places that have access to the internet, and you can see that most of them are represented, and, you know, the number one city that accesses the website is London, followed by New York. So it gives you an idea of the range of places where people are coming from. In terms of U.S. visitors, this is a question that we are often asked for. I'm using some of the statistics from a website called Quantcast that gives you some extra stats on your website. So according to this website, you know, here is the line for what's considered internet average. So we are about internet average in terms of percentage of Caucasians, above average in terms of Asian, and others also above average. So it just gives you an idea of the range of people who participate in the community. The third thing that I wanted to mention was, you know, a lot of the times when we think about educational technology or learning technologies, we think in the context of schools. And while this is a valid approach, I will argue that it is important or even very useful to try to circumvent schools. And I'm just going to give you an example. So when we started with Scratch, actually when I started developing the online community, one of the things that I did was to partner with this organization called Citizen Schools. I don't know how many of you have heard of Citizen Schools. It's a really cool organization. I'll recommend you to contact them. They're all over the country. Basically, if you are an adult with some skill, any skill, you can join this organization and offer a class on whatever you are. If you're a lawyer or a programmer or a, you know, anything that you do, you can teach kids how to do those things. So I decided to join as a mentor in this organization to teach kids how to program using Scratch and also to kind of bootstrap the community. So I had a group of like about 20 kids who came to the Media Lab at MIT, and I, you know, taught them programming using Scratch in the lab, and they were really excited, and I was showing them also the website. Of course, at that point, the website was kind of empty. They were the very first users, so there was not really much of a purpose for them to share on the website, but it's really served, you know, as kind of beta testing as well as kind of to seed the website with real content from real users. And then a few weeks later, after we released the website, we got this article on the BBC, and again, this kind of tells you some of the power of, you know, traditional media. And this article got tons of views. It got on Slashdot and Dig and all these websites. And it got a lot of attention for the community. And this is, I think, how we started to become really kind of visible outside, you know, the academic circles. After this news came out, you know, the website went down for a few hours because we couldn't handle the traffic. You can imagine that after that, a lot of people found out about Scratch, and it became more of a household name for people who were interested in programming languages for kids. So I will say that in terms of vectors for adoption, I will talk about four different vectors. So the first one is parents. You know, a lot of the people who came to the BBC website were not kids. Obviously, you know, most of the kids don't go to read the BBC, but parents did, and a lot of the parents who are interested in technology were checking out the BBC website, and then they recommended Scratch to their kids. So that was the very first, like, early adopters, you know, the techie parents showing Scratch to their kids. The second one was these after-school centers. So in addition to the Citizen Schools program, we partnered with a bunch of other programs like the Intel Computer Clubhouse, you know, a lot of different programs that kind of teach programming after school, because, you know, traditional schools are kind of hard to change, and, you know, if you want to introduce a new technology, you have to, you know, make sure that it's part of the curriculum, so that's kind of complicated. Then after that, you know, kids, word of mouth. That was one of the next waves. You know, kids who learn through their parents or through after schools, then show it to other kids, and that's how it starts spreading. Then, you know, the last one, which is where we are right now, is schools. So now that schools were realizing that tons of kids were using these and a lot of them were doing really interesting things, then they were, oh, maybe I can introduce this as part of my curriculum. So a lot of the schools are now starting to use Scratch as part of their class activities. The fourth point that I want to make is this idea of connecting with strangers. So when we think about online communities for kids, one of the biggest fears is, you know, parents and the media have perpetuated this image or this idea that, you know, the internet is full of predators and it's really dangerous and so on. Well, that's definitely a concern to have. I think there is a lot of value in, you know, being part of a community and connecting with people that you don't know. In fact, when I was, you know, young in Mexico, I remember one of the most exciting experiences for me was to, you know, be online and, you know, connect with other people from all over the world. And I feel like we have kind of lost that aspect of the internet. And I feel like given the right infrastructure and the right, you know, mentoring, it is a really powerful way for building communities and for, you know, broadening our mindset as a kid. So I'm going to show you some examples of how that has influenced Scratch. So the first one is this one. So this girl, Boopaloop, that's the name of the creator, created this project. It was a series of sprites. A sprite is a character in Scratch. And she basically, you know, showed a bunch of sprites, and she said in the project notes, you know, here are some simple walking sprites. They're perfect for platform games, so she kind of invited other people to maybe use these things. And then she says, if you want a sprite of your very own, you can leave a comment in my gallery. Say what you want, and I will do it for you. Be patient, because it might take a few weeks. I am very busy. So you can see this girl, you know, created something for others to reuse, and then invited other people to say, you know, if you want something, I can make it for you. A few weeks after that, this girl posted a comment underneath that project, and the comment said, you know, can you make a mountain background? And then she said, I'm going to give it, I love it. So when you look at a project, you can love it if you like it. So she said, I'm going to give it, I love it. And I put it in my favorites in case I need more sprites for my miniature company called Cranking. So she kind of created this company. And she said, it's not a real company. It's just one that I made up. And then she said, we make very good quality games. I only made two so far because I don't want to make rubbish ones. And then she says, if all you do is simply send in a project, I will review it back, and if it's good enough, I'll accept you in the company. So these two girls started to collaborate. One will make the sprites, the other one will kind of do the integration, and they created this company, the Cranking. A few weeks later, we had kids from all over joining the company. So the first two girls, one of them was from the UK, the other one was from Ireland. And they both started to collaborate. And then later on, this girl from Russia joined and this boy from New Jersey. So they started to create like a really an active group making projects. And you can see some of their titles. So the creator of the company was the programmer and the chair lady and game creator. So each one of them had their own title that they came up with. And little by little, they started to get a lot of requests to join to this company. So they couldn't handle so many requests. So they had to set a set of rules, like, okay, you need to submit a portfolio of what are the kind of things you have made. So they will look at your profile and see all the projects that they had made. And they were like, okay, you're a good programmer. Maybe you can join us. But they couldn't accept everyone. So, you know, at some point they had to say, you know, we are full. We don't accept any more people. But then it became a thing. A lot of the kids who were not accepted in the company, they were like, well, I'm going to create my own company, you know, if I cannot join this one. So then now it's a phenomenon in the community that, you know, once you're an established member of the community, you often, you know, create these groups or companies or collabs, whatever you want to call them. We looked at one of these particular companies, one called Grey Bear Productions, and we looked over the course of 3 months, they made about 6 games. A lot of them were really, really good games. And each game required, on average, 17 remixes. Again, it tells you some of the power of this idea of building with other people and sending files through the website as a way to kind of do some kind of version control, if you're familiar with this term. So let me just give you a quick tour over, you know, a particular story that involved a bunch of remixes. So each one of these is a project, and each connection is a remix. So it all started with this project called the Jumping Monkey. So this project was one of those games that you control with a keyboard, and the monkey will go up these lines and capture the bananas. So this project was made by Kay Doodle. So she made that. She posted it on the website. It got 200 views. Not that many, but, you know, decent amount of views. A few weeks later, this kid, Mayhem, he made this project based on K-Doodles, and it says something like, I made some simple modifications to K-Doodles. I added pink slippers. So basically, the monkey now has these pink slippers that allow you to detect the black line more easily. So it was a nice technique for improving the how the game is played. And then he says, you know, I needed up some of the platforms and blah, blah, blah. So then that project got remixed again. By this kid who was more of an established member of the community. And you can see that he added these kind of obstacles like fire. And he says, you know, how I made this? Well, I adapted this shoot technique from K-Doodle's Jumping Monkey. And then you can see how they start building on previous work. Later on, this other kid Duiber, he made this project, and before he made the project, he posted a comment on the previous project, and he said, "Hey Wiz, I love this game. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind me making some changes." And the Wiz, this kid, says, "Oh, no problem. In fact, I need someone to help me make games for my production company, Super Software." And then they went on to make projects together as a company. So you can see that remixing also plays a role of, you know, connecting people with similar interests. Obviously, this kid over here had, you know, a more of an advanced technique for making these more Nintendo-looking games, but, you know, he really needed some of the coding behind the project, so they found each other and started to collaborate. And you can see each one of those red dots is a remix, so you can see that there's a lot of generativity that came after that particular project was released. So that's one example that gives you an idea of this idea of connecting with strangers and how powerful it is. The fifth idea that I wanted to share with you is, you know, we have a lot of fear out there for cyberbullying and things like this. And obviously, it's a really, really important problem. But I think when you're designing online communities, you can go overboard and you can go into a more kind of create a very sterile community. And I've seen a lot of communities, especially commercial communities, that try to convince parents that they should join. They often don't allow a lot of expressive power to the kids. So I know at some point I looked at Club Penguin, for example, and you can see that in order to chat with other people, one of the options was that you can only select from drop-down menus. So you can only select from like a bunch of different words and you can only say certain kind of things. So it was very restrictive. Of course, there are reasons for doing that, but I think there is there is something to think about when you know any community will have some friction, and I think that kind of friction sometimes could be productive. So I'm going to show you an example of that. So we had a lot of, as I showed you before, we have a lot of remixes of other people's projects. So sometimes when people remix other people's projects, people leave these comments like, you know, "I love what you did with my code. It was a great idea." But sometimes we get comments like this one where, you know, people say, "You're a copycat," "You're a plagiarist," or even things like this. So you can see that, you know, people are very protective of their work. A lot of the kids, despite the fact that we often hear on the media how, you know, kids don't care about copyright or, you know, they kind of are kind of interested in copying anything that they see online, when it comes to their content, they're very protective of it. And we see this in the tensions around remixing. In fact, one of the things that we saw is the creation of this company that its whole purpose was to go around the website and kind of be like this vigilante group that will flag projects as inappropriate when they were remixes. They were trying to kind of take down all the plagiarism and all the plagiarist, you know, projects, and they became this like little group with badges, and like they were like going around the website and helping each other, you know, take down all these kind of projects. So this is something that we saw, and in some ways it's a kind of, you could argue, it's a product, perhaps a productive way of, you know, coming together to tackle this problem that they see. One of the things that we wanted to understand was, you know, how people, you know, think about remixing, how kids think about intellectual property. So we looked at a lot of the comments, let me see, of that people leave on projects that are remixes, and, you know, about 20% of them were positive comments, and about other 20% were, you know, clearly negative. And you can see, I mean, the rest were kind of comments that didn't have any particular valence. But you can see that these created some friction in the community. And that leads me to the sixth point, which is this idea of productive friction. So one of the things that we saw is that people were upset about remixing. You know, some people, not everyone. And some kids started to suggest solutions for that. So this was one of the solutions. So this kid suggested that maybe when you download Scratch file, after being uploaded, you should mark it with the creator's name at the bottom. It's kind of like giving automatic attribution to projects. And actually, I thought that was a good idea. You know, why should people, you know, download something and not get any credit for that? So I decided to implement this idea. And you can see now in every remix, you can see the attribution here. So this is the name of the person who shared the remix, and this is the name of the person on which the remix is based on. So I thought this was going to solve the problem of, you know, people getting upset about remixing. But it turns out that it made no difference. We coded again all the comments that people left before and after, and here you can pay attention to the percentages. So the number of people who were silent was almost the same. There was no statistical difference. The number of people who left positive comments was almost the same with negative and other. So it was almost no difference before and after this automatic attribution. So I tried to understand better why this was happening. And I started browsing through many remixes and trying to see, you know, if I could understand this. And you can see, for example, in this remix, despite the fact that there is this attribution here, the automatic attribution that the system leaves, there is a bunch of text here that basically gives credit to the previous people on which the project is based on. So it says, you know, credit to the 1UP for the, you know, Navi Sparta remix, so-and-so for the sounds, so-and-so for the music, so-and-so for the animation. So you can see that despite the fact that the system was given attribution automatically, there was still the need for giving this credit manually. So then we went and encoded all the remixes that we had at the time, and we compared them, those with credit, those without credit, and we interested out that there was a difference. So you can see that people were more positive when, you know, projects had credit in it. And this, you know, gets to the idea of friction. So oftentimes when we think of, for example, Facebook birthdays, you know, if Facebook reminds people of my birthday and people just, you know, remember because of that, then I feel less, you know, that is less valuable. So a lot of the systems that we implement often remove this friction. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's useful, but sometimes you want that friction and sometimes you want that kind of human-to-human interaction. And here is something that one of the kids said. I interviewed a bunch of kids as well about remixing and what they thought about it. And so here I asked this kid what they thought about remixing. Let's see if I can.
Give me a definition of remix. Taking somebody else's project and then changing a lot of it and sharing it and giving credit.
So you can see that the idea of giving credit, again, was a very important part of, you know, a valid remix. I also show this kid a bunch of examples on paper of projects with and without credit, trying to understand this idea of, you know, how this friction might be helpful or not. And I ask him, you know, what do you think about, I don't have this one. But I ask him basically, what do you think about these different projects? And, you know, a lot of the things he said were, basically a good remix is one that leaves credit and also that makes a lot of changes to it. So the idea is that not only that you should leave credit, but also that you should be, you know, you should build on top of it and show that you put some effort into it. The seventh point that I want to make is around incentives. So again, with this idea of remixing, one of the things that we often thought about is how do we solve this, of these, you know, people being upset about remixing. So one of the things that we did was to introduce on the homepage of the website, which, by the way, being on the front page of the website is like a big deal for the kids because, you know, your project, it gets a lot of visibility and so on. So we thought about adding a top remix section to the front page. So, you know, if your project gets remixed a lot, then your project might be on the front page. So the idea behind this is that maybe you should be not upset, but actually happy when somebody remixes your project because you can be on the front page. And this actually kind of worked. The number of complaints was reduced. But one of the things that changed a lot was the nature of remixing. So before that intervention, most of the remixes look like this, you know, concentrical number of remixes that grew out of one particular original project. But after the intervention, we saw things more like this, where they became more like these complex trees. And a lot of them were these chain remixes. Like, for example, this one is about being putting your name on the left if you're a boy, or, I'm sorry, if you're a girl, and putting your name on the right if you're a boy. And this was inviting people to, please download this and put your name if you're a boy or a girl. So obviously a lot of kids had something to say about this, so they downloaded that. And you can see the chain of remixes kind of expanded beyond the number of levels that we had before. Before, the maximum number of levels that we had were 5 levels of remixing. That's the one of the particular projects that had the most number of remixes. And now, after that, you can see there are tons of different levels and tons of like branches of these remixing trees. So this kind of gets to, at least to me, one of the ideas behind gamification is often about introducing incentives, or kind of like giving points or giving some kind of recognition in exchange for some behavior. And that is very powerful. People do respond to that. But it's often, you know, it can introduce a lot of changes in the community. So in this case, one of the things that happened is that a lot of these chain remixes that came out of this intervention became really shallow remixes, where it's like just about adding your name to, you know, to a list of names or doing really, really simple changes. So that's something just to consider. You might increase participation, but the quality of the projects might reduce. And that's just something that I feel that oftentimes happens with gamification. The final point that I want to make is about user innovation. So while we think about, you know, kids, we don't often think about kids themselves becoming active participants of the system production itself. But actually, that's not the case. We've seen a couple of examples where kids have driven the innovation in Scratch itself. So one of them is this particular analysis that I did. So I looked at all the projects that we had, 2 million projects, and all of them had, you know, programs that are called scripts. And the most popular scripts are these ones. So I looked at a lot of them, and they made sense, most of them. You know, like, for example, when I receive hide, it's often used in animations where if you want to show something first and then hide it later on, that's what you do. But then I found this one, and I was kind of perplexed by it. This one was basically this piece of software that was very popular, obviously, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And actually, when I went and looked back at what this represented, what it represented was what they call scrolling games, kind of like Mario games, where you need to set the X coordinate of the character to a particular variable that changes dynamically. So I was like, really surprised that something so complex became so popular. And it actually came out from this kid who made a template for making scrolling games. And then it became kind of the de facto standard for making these games. So you can see that this innovation spreads from kids to kids as well. Another example of this user innovation was this website, created by two kids, one of them in Belgium and the other one here in the US, that looked at the Scratch website allows people to only share projects, finished projects. But it doesn't allow you to share the kind of scripts or music or sounds very easily. So this kid made a website just for sharing kind of components of projects. And when I saw that website, I was really surprised. You know, first of all, the website was very well made. And second, you know, I thought it was a good thing to do. And so I kind of invited him to host his website on our kind of infrastructure. And he was very happy to do that. And he even connected the authentication mechanism of our website to his website. And the website is still running. And it's one of the most popular kind of external websites that we have. Another example of this user innovation is this wiki that a lot of the kids maintain. And basically what they do in this wiki, they do a lot of kind of documentation on how to use Scratch, documentation on how the community is run, some of the standards in the community. And it's very, very active. It's a small number of kids who are really invested in this wiki. And again, I saw that happening on a different website, in Wikia. They were hosting it with tons of ads and so on. So I invited them to host the wiki in our site again and trying to really support this kind of innovation that was happening at the margins that actually turns out to be really, really useful for building the community. So just to end, and I'm going to open it up for questions, you know, now that I've been working on Scratch for a few years, I'm working in a new system called Kodu. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Kodu. Kodu is a project by Microsoft Research. It's a programming language, just like Scratch, for kids. The difference is that it's for making programs and games for the Xbox. You know, a lot of the kids who use Scratch oftentimes, you know, they want to make projects that go beyond just the web and beyond just this like little square on the screen, and they want to make something three-dimensional and something more kind of for a console, basically. So the idea behind Kodu is to build on some of these ideas of Scratch. You can see the programming is still based on blocks. It's a little bit simpler because you are supposed to use the remote controller of the Xbox, and that's how you program, by adding these kind of constructs. And the kind of games that you make are more like three-dimensional games that are more kind of aligned with the way you know, the Xbox experience is like. So one of the things that we are doing, we are building an online community around Kodu to encourage, again, this kind of participation. Because, again, any of these tools is really exciting when you're working on your own, but at some point you want to share it with other people, not just your friends that live around you or your parents. So this idea of having an audience, I think, is really empowering for a lot of the kids who are making things online. And you can see this happening on YouTube and many other communities where kids are hanging out. So with that, I want to open it up for questions. And I just want to thank some of my collaborators that have worked on these projects and others. Thank you. Yeah, it's fine.
Okay. I wanted to say, just to tell you a little story, I moderate a website for kids where they make little animated movies. Mm-hmm. And around the question of copycatting,
right,
they did the exact same thing.
Really?
They set up a police force.
Wow.
And they would go around to each other's movies and arrest each other.
What is the website?
The Zimmer Twins.
Image?
The Zimmer Twins.
The Zimmer Twins. Oh, okay, cool. I'll check it out.
I was, when you were telling that, I was like, oh my God. So I think there must be some, I think the thing about attribution is that,
right,
it's,
right.
And it's not voluntary, they don't.
Please don't. How old are they?
Same age.
Same age.
A little younger, they track like 11.
I see.
10 or 10.
That's awesome.
And then the question I have for you is actually just, we'd love to be able to study the movies that they make to see what components are repeating and what mm-hmm. trends are happening. And I was just wondering how you get your data visual. Like, what are you just doing, like database queries and cross-referencing?
Yeah, it's been complicated because originally Scratch was not designed for analytics. And so one of the things that I had to do is create this program that basically explodes all the internals of a project and puts them into a structured format in a database. So it basically analyzes all the images, analyzes all the scripts and all the components, and then puts them into this database that then I can use to query. But that took a lot of effort. And I wish I, at the beginning I had, you know, built the whole infrastructure to allow for more easily, you know, analyzing all this data. But it, you know, it definitely is something that I think is useful for, you know, just seeing how the community evolves. But there is a big cost to it. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It varies a lot. So I think in the younger the kid is or the less experienced the kid is, probably the more mentoring they need. So say if a parent is working with a six-year-old, typically, you know, maybe the parent is the one controlling the mouse if the kid doesn't know how to move the mouse very well. But I think it's definitely possible to go very young as long as you are willing to spend a lot of time and, you know, basically do it for them or with them. Basically, a lot of things that I've seen is that kids start describing what they want to make, and the adult basically is doing it with them and say, okay, if you want to make this, you know, let's do that. One of the challenges with these tools is that a lot of the kids who are already, you know, very familiar with video games and animations, they have these like really crazy ideas of what they want to make, and they have like really, really high expectations. So I think one of the roles of a mentor is to say, okay, those are really cool ideas, and definitely one day you'll be able to do that. But let's start with something simpler than that. And maybe you can take that big idea and say, why don't we make it just with one character? And then you start playing with that. I think part of the challenges with any of these tools is that they're very open-ended, which, you know, some people are really thrive in those environments, and other people are kind of overwhelmed and just kind of, you know, think about what exactly they want to make or how to even start. Yeah.
Is it its own plugin? Is that how it works? Or what kind of technology?
Yeah, so the technology behind Scratch is the desktop environment is an application that you download, although now we are building a web-based version of that. And on the web, in order to render the project, it's using Flash, Adobe Flash. There are actually two options. One is with Java, which is the default, and the other one is with Flash. Now the new version of Scratch will be made with a completely on the web and with Flash. We've been playing with the idea of using HTML5, but there are a lot of the things that we need for Scratch that are not yet ready in HTML5.
For Nickelodeon, we have a game creator.
Oh, cool.
It's all Flash, too. Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah, one of the challenges is that, you know, the iPad and all other tablets not necessarily support Flash very well. So that's definitely a challenge of these technologies. Yeah. Cool. Yes?
Can you talk about the level of primary or secondary market research you had to do before you kicked Scratch off?
Well, we didn't really start with market research per se. Well, one of the things that we did... before we started with Scratch, we were using Lego Mindstorms and tools like Logo in many different settings, from schools to after-school centers. And as part of that kind of activity, we realized that a lot of what the kids wanted to do was kind of use something like Photoshop, but go beyond just, you know, making changes to an image and make it more dynamic. So kind of the Scratch grew out of that realization. So in some ways, the market research happened over the course of many years interacting with kids. We didn't really like start saying, you know, let's make any project. What is a good project to make? It was more of out of a need that we saw in the community. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
So I see here a list of finance support from. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Let you go off and do this dream, and you know, then you're not working for us if we don't get anything out of it.
Right.
So, do you make money from this, or where does your money come from? Or
yeah, Scratch is a completely a non-profit effort. So, it was originally funded by the National Science Foundation. So they gave a bunch of dollars, and that's how the project got started. And the Media Lab itself at MIT is funded by corporations, and some of those corporations give funding to specific projects. So Lego was obviously one of the people who were interested in this. So it's definitely a challenge. And I see that, you know, oftentimes when I see startups, they often lean on the side of you know, I think not making the best kind of more idealistic kind of startup just because you need to make money, and then there are things that you need to compromise. But I think definitely by now I feel that the project itself could be self-sustained just by the traffic that we have, and also I think a lot of people, not everyone, will be willing to pay for access to a tool like this. And I see this with other tools, like, I don't know if you're familiar with Aviary. It's like a kind of like a Photoshop online, where they're trying to figure out how to commercialize some of these creative tools. And I think there are different models. The typical one where you offer something basic first for free, and then you offer the full-fledged version for charge. So yeah, I guess we are not the best example of how to make this profitable. And I don't know, really how to do that. But I definitely know that there's a lot of interest out there from nonprofits or like National Science Foundation or the MacArthur Foundation to support some of these projects. So I think if you look around, you'll find a lot of organizations that are willing to fund this kind of this kind of work, and people who actually want to make a change in schools and education. Yeah. Yes. Right. That's a good question. So yeah, actually, I will say that maybe 70% of the time that we spent on the building of these tools has been invested in moderation and tools for moderation. So it's really expensive in terms of the amount of time, but it's also really rewarding in the sense that you learn a lot from the community. So the way it works right now is we have a group of people who review. When people flag content, they review it manually, and they also go around and look for projects and so on. And one of the decisions that we made from the very beginning was that everything was going to be public. And I think this kind of reduced some of the fear about this idea of contacting strangers in private. And I agree. I think in general it has made things a lot simpler and a lot easier to manage. But there's a lot of work there. So we have some volunteers and some people that that we pay to review some of this content and to get it, to be engaged in the community. So at the very beginning it was just me, and I spent tons and tons of hours posting comments on people's projects and really engaging with the community. And afterwards it was just hard to scale, and we had to hire people. Yeah. Yes.
Right.
So the way we deal with this, the way all the other user-generated contents website deal with, which is the DMCA has this provision where you can basically sign up with the government to say we are a kind of platform where people post content, and that protects you for any kind of liability as long as when you get a takedown notice, you actually remove the content. So in the past 4 or 5 years, we received about maybe 5 DMCA notices from lawyers that are well written and so on. And some of them, actually, there was this one where Namco, which is the owner of Pac-Man, sent us a cease and desist letter for a game called Pac-Man that one of the kids made. But it was obviously a game made by a kid. It was just hand-drawn. And I was surprised that Namco will care about this game, because who will use that instead of the original one? But they were really upset about it. So they sent this cease and desist letter, and we were like, well, we have to take it down. So we took it down, and we put a message saying, we took this down because Namco, complained. And all the kids started to really, rally against Namco, and they were like, I'm never going to buy a game by Namco anymore. And they even created a remix chain where it's like, add yourself getting sued by Namco, and it's like these kids running around. It was really funny. And so I think in general, this idea of copyright has really been one of the main drivers for discussion in the community, and a lot of it is really productive discussion about, what are my rights and responsibilities as a creator in terms of, using other people's content or other people using my content. So it's been really, really interesting. And in terms of the legal issues, I think it has been somewhat easy to manage because, people just send cease and desist notice and we take it down. It's not that big of a deal. Right, so we have one full-time person that is a community moderator, and three volunteers that are helping this person. So that's basically and how it's run right now. And then, you know, in, more on the kind of technology side, I was the one, you know, building all the web infrastructure. And I hire, you know, contractors once in a while to improve, you know, performance or all these kind of things. But it was very easy, actually. It was at MIT, we have this program called the Undergraduate Research Opportunity Program, where undergrads can work for you for free. And so we had this army of undergrads who, I mean, they were not the most productive group of people, but it was easy to get, you know, some technical help that way. So that's one way in which we kind of got a lot of the infrastructure built. And now that we have more visibility, we hire two developers that are basically in charge of developing the new version of Scratch that is going to be completely web-based. And I think, I mean, the more visibility that you get, the more grant money probably you can get. So in that sense, it hasn't been that hard to scale it up. Okay. Cool. Yes.
Two questions. How have you dealt with COPPA compliance? And then have you had any companies take the opposite position of AMCO, where they want to partner with you and your programmers?
Yeah, so about the Child Online Protection Act. So basically what we do is we do not ask any personal information. In order to sign up, if you are under 13, we ask you for your parents' email. And the only thing you need to do is just put a username, a password, and your email. And the rest is, you know, completely optional. The other thing with the COPPA is that, from what I understand, I'm not a lawyer, but from what I understand, it only applies to for-profit companies. But in any case, I mean, it's a good thing not to ask for personal information. So we don't really care, you know, what the name of the person is or anything like that. So that's one. The other question was? Oh, how to partner with companies. So when we get complaints from companies, we often reply to them saying, you know, this is an educational project, and, you know, we would like to, you know, allow people to share things and so on. And some companies respond nicely, and they're like, oh, okay, fine. And other people have requested to be able to maybe capitalize on some of the content. And so far we have not done that just because we are a project running at a university, so we don't really want to have advertisement. But I definitely see that there will be a lot of companies interested in you know, getting kids engaged in this kind of creating of content with their brand. And I guess kind of going back to the question of, you know, how do you make profit out of this, I could definitely see that as a possible way in which you can make more money. Yeah.
Who owns the game IP?
MIT. Oh, you mean the game, the software, or each project? Right, so the IP of Scratch itself and the website is owned by MIT, and, you know, there are channels on how to get access to that. The software itself is also free and open source, so, you know, if you are interested in the code itself, it's there. So, and
I'm talking about, like, game development.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see, yes. Yeah, so the projects themselves are owned by the kids who upload them, and everything is shared by default on their Creative Commons license. And actually, that's a controversial topic in the community where a lot of the kids are not happy with sharing things in a Creative Commons license. But for two reasons, we decided to keep it that way. One is that just simplicity. If you had like five options of all the, you know, CC licenses, it might be complicated to understand and also complicated to enforce. And since we see a lot of complaints about remixing, we decided to only allow CC licenses, and if you are not happy with that, then obviously you can share your project somewhere else. And so far it has worked well, but I definitely think that there is a space for maybe, you know, allowing people to select, like in Flickr, you can select what license you want. And so far we haven't done that, but I think in future versions of Scratch it will be good to do that. The challenge, again, is how to enforce some of those things, and then you get to spend a lot of time, you know, trying to decide whether something is attribution or share alike or, you know, commercial or not. So, yeah. Yes? Yes. The license is, for the website, is GPL. And for the tool, the editing tool, is a non-commercial license, basically, that you can do anything as long as it's non-commercial. If you want commercial use, then you can, I guess, license it through MIT or something like that. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you very much.